This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents Child of God by Cormac McCarthy, narrated by Tom Stekschulte, and directed by Inukenti Aksentiev.
Part 1. They came like a caravan of carnival folk up through the swales of broom straw and across the hill in the morning sun. The truck rocking and pitching in the ruts, and the musicians on chairs in the truck bed teetering and tuning their instruments. The fat man with guitar grinning and gesturing to others in a car behind, and bending to give a note to the fiddler, who turned a fiddle peg and listened with a wrinkled face. They passed under flowering apple trees and passed a log crib, chinked with orange mud, and forded a branch and came in sight of an aged clapboard house that stood in blue shade under the wall of the mountain. Beyond it stood a barn. One of the men in the truck bonged on the cab roof with his fist, and the truck came to a halt. Cars and trucks came on through the weeds in the yard, people afoot. To watch these things issuing from the otherwise mute pastoral morning is a man at the barn door. He's small, unclean, unshaven. He moves in the dry chaff among the dust and slats of sunlight with a constrained truculence. Saxon and Celtic bloods. A child of God, much like yourself, perhaps. Wasps pass through the laddered light from the barn slats in a succession of strobic moments, gold and trembling between black and black, like fireflies in the serried upper gloom. The man stands straddle-legged, has made in the dark humus a darker pool, wherein swirls a pale foam with bits of straw. Buttoning his jeans, he moves along the barn wall, himself fiddle-backed with light, a petty annoyance flickering across the wallward eye. Standing in the fore-bay door, he blinks. Behind him, there is a rope hanging from the loft. His thinly bristled jaw knots and slacks as if he were chewing, but he is not chewing. His eyes are almost shut against the sun, and through the thin and blue-veined lids, you can see the eyeballs moving, watching. A man in a blue suit gesturing from the truck bed, a lemonade stand going up, the musicians striking up a country reel and the yard filling up with people and the loudspeaker making a few first squawks.
All right now, let's get everybody up here and get registered for ye free silver dollars. Right up here, that's a way. How you, little lady? Well, all right. Yes, sir. All right now. Jesse, have you got it? All right now. Now, Jess and them has got the house open for them that wants to see inside. That's all right. We're fixing to have some music here in just a minute, and we want to get everybody registered before we have the drawings. Yes, sir? What's that? Yes, sir. That's right. That's right, everybody. We will bid on the tracks, and then we'll have a chance to bid on the whole. They's both sides of the road now. It goes plumb across the creek to them big timbers on the other side yonder. Yes, sir. We'll get into that directly.
Bowing, pointing, smiling, the microphone in one hand, among the pines on the ridge, the sound of the auctioneer's voice echoed, muted, redundant. An illusion of multiple voices, a ghost chorus among old ruins.
Now, they's good timber up here, too. Real good timber. It's been cut over 15-20 years ago, and so maybe it ain't big timber yet, but looky here. While you're a-laying down there in your bed at night, this timber is up here growing, yes, sir. And I mean that sincerely. They is real future in this property. As much future as you'll find anywheres in this valley. Maybe more. Friends, they is no limit to the possibilities on a piece of property like this. I'd buy it myself if I had any more money. And I believe you all know that every penny I own is in real estate, and every one I've made has been from real estate. If I had $1 million, I would have it every cent invested in real estate within 90 days, and you all know that. They ain't no way for it to go but up. A piece of land like this here, I sincere believe, will give ye 10% on your investment and maybe more, maybe as high as 20%. Your money down here in this bank won't do that for ye, and you all know that. There is no sounder investment than property. Land. You all know that a dollar won't buy what it used to buy. A dollar might not be worth but 50 cents a year from now. And you all know that. But real estate is going up, up, up. Friends, 6 years ago when my uncle bought the Prater place down here, everybody tried to talk him out of it. He'd give 19.5 for that farm, said, I know what I'm a-doing, and you all know what happened down there. Yes, sir. Sold for $38,000, a piece of land like this. Now, it needs some improving. It's rough, yes it is, but friends, you can double your money on it. A piece of real estate, and particular in this valley, is the soundest investment you can make. Sound as a dollar, and I'm very sincere when I say that. In the pines, the voices chanted a lost litany. Then they stopped. A murmur went through the crowd. The auctioneer had handed over the microphone to another man. The other man said, "Holler at the sheriff yonder, C.B." The auctioneer waved his hand at him and bent to the man standing in front of him, small man, ill-shaven, now holding a rifle.
"What do you want, Lester?"
"I done told ye. I want you to get your goddamn ass off my property and take these fools with ye."
"Watch your mouth, Lester. These ladies present, I don't give a fuck who's present. It ain't your property, the hell it ain't. You done been locked up once over this. Now, I guess you want to go again. The high sheriff is standing right over yonder."
"I don't give a good goddamn where the high sheriff is at. I want you sons of bitches off my goddamned property, you hear?"
The auctioneer was squatting on the tailboard of the truck. He looked down at his shoes, plucked idly at a piece of dried mud in the welt. When he looked back up at the man with a rifle, he was smiling. He said,
"Lester, you don't get a grip on yourself, they're going to put you in a rubber room."
The man took a step backward, the rifle in one hand. He was almost crouching, and he held his free hand out with the fingers spread toward the crowd as if to hold them back.
"Get down off that truck," he hissed.
The man on the truck spat and squinted at him.
"What you aim to do, Lester, shoot me? I didn't take your place off of ye. County done that. I was just hired as auctioneer." "Get off that truck."
Behind him, the musicians looked like compositions in porcelain from an old county fair shooting gallery.
"He's crazy, C.B.
C.B. said,
"You want to shoot me, Lester? You can shoot me where I'm at. I ain't going nowheres for you."
Lester Ballard never could hold his head right after that. It must have thawed his neck out some way or another. I didn't see Buster hit him, but I seen him laying on the ground. I was with the sheriff. He was laying flat on the ground looking up at everybody with his eyes crossed and this awful pump knot on his head. He just laid there, and he was bleeding at the ears. Buster was still standing there holding the axe. They took him on in the county car, and C.B. went on with the auction like nothing never had happened. But he did say that it caused some folks not to bid that otherwise would have, which may have been what Lester set out at, I don't know. John Greer was from up in Granger County, not saying nothing against him, but he was. Fred Kirby was squatting in his front yard next to the water tap where he used to sit all the time when Ballard came by. Ballard stood in the road and looked up at him. He said,
"Hey, Fred."
Kirby lifted his hand and nodded.
"Come up, Lester," he said.
Ballard came to the edge of the cut bank and looked up to where Kirby was sitting. He said,
"You got any whiskey?"
"Might have some."
"Why don't you let me have a jar?"
Kirby stood up. Ballard said,
"I can pay you next week on it."
Kirby squatted back down again.
"I can pay ye tomorrow," Ballard said.
Kirby turned his head to one side and gripped his nose between his thumb and forefinger and sneezed a gout of yellow snot into the grass and wiped his fingers on the knee of his jeans. He looked out over the fields.
"I can't do it, Lester," he said.
Ballard half turned to see what he was looking at out there, but there was nothing but the same mountains. He shifted his feet and reached into his pocket.
"You want to trade it out?" he said.
"Might do. What you got?"
"Got this here pocket knife."
"Let's see it."
Ballard opened the knife and pitched it up the bank at Kirby. It stuck up in the ground near his shoe. Kirby looked at it a minute and then reached down and got it and wiped the blade on his knee and looked at the name on it. He closed it and opened it again, and he pared a thin peeling from the sole of his shoe.
"All right," he said.
He stood up and put the knife in his pocket and crossed the road toward the creek. Ballard watched him scout along the edge of the field, kicking at the bushes and honeysuckle, Once or twice he looked back. Ballard was watching off toward the Blue Hills. After a while, Kirby came back, but he didn't have any whiskey. He handed Ballard his knife back.
Can't find it, he said.
Can't find it?
No.
Well, shit far.
I'll hunt some more later on. I think I was drunk when I hit it.
Where'd you hide it at?
I don't know. I thought I could go straight to it, but I must not have put it where I thought it was.
Well, goddamn.
If I can't find it, I'll get some more.
Ballard put the knife in his pocket and turned and went back up the road. All that remained of the outhouse were a few soft shards of planking grown with a virid moss and lying collapsed in a shallow hole where weeds sprouted in outsized mutations. Ballard passed by and went behind the barn where he trod a clearing in the clumps of jimson and nightshade and squatted and shat. A bird sat among the hot and dusty bracken. Bird flew. He wiped himself with a stick and rose and pulled his trousers up from the ground. Already green flies clamored over his dark and lumpy stool. He buttoned his trousers and went back to the house. This house had two rooms, each room two windows. Looking out the back, there was a solid wall of weeds high as the house eaves. In the front was a porch and more weeds. From the road a quarter mile off, travelers could see the gray shake roof and chimney, nothing more. Ballard trampled a path through the weeds to the back door. A hornet's nest hung from the corner of the porch, and he knocked it down. The hornets came out one by one and flew away. Ballard went inside and, with a piece of cardboard, swept the floor. He swept up the old newspapers, and he swept out the dried dung of foxes and possums, and he swept out bits of brick-colored mud fallen from the board ceiling with their black husks of pupae. He closed the window. The one pane left tilted soundlessly from the dry sash and fell into his hands. He set it on the sill. In the hearth lay a pile of bricks and mortar clay, half an iron fire dog. He threw the bricks out and swept up the clay, and on his hands and shin bones craned his neck to see up the chimney. In the patch of roomy light, a spider hung, a rank odor of earth and old wood smoke. He wadded newspapers and set them in the hearth and lit them. They burned slowly. Small flames sputtered and ate their way along the rims and edges. The papers blackened and curled and shivered, and the spider descended by a thread and came to rest, clutching itself on the ashy floor of the hearth. Late in the afternoon, a small thin mattress of stained ticking forded the break toward the cabin. It was hinged over the head and shoulders of Lester Ballard, whose muffled curses at the bullbriars and blackberries reached no ear. When he got to the cabin, he pitched the mattress off onto the floor. A frame of dust plumed from under and rolled out along the cupped floorboards and subsided. Ballard raised the front of his shirt and wiped the sweat from his face and from his head. He looked half crazy. By dark, he had all he owned about him in the barren room, and he had lit a lamp and set it in the middle of the floor, and he was sitting cross-legged before it. He was holding a coat hanger skewered with sliced potatoes over the lamp chimney. When they were nearly black, he slid them off the wire with his knife onto a plate and speared one up and blew on it and bit into it. He sat with his mouth open, sucking air in and out, the piece of potato cradled on his lower teeth. He cursed the potato for being hot while he chewed it. It was raw in the middle, tasted of coal oil. When he'd eaten the potato, he rolled himself a cigarette and lit it over the quaking cone of gas at the rim of the lamp chimney, and sat there sucking in the smoke and letting it curl from his lip, his nostrils, idly tapping the ash with his little finger into his trouser cuff. He spread the newspapers he had gathered and muttered over them, his lips forming the words. Old news of folks long dead, events forgotten, ads for patent medicine and livestock for sale. He smoked the cigarette down until it was just a burnt nubbin in his fingers, until it was ash. He turned down the lamp until just the faintest orange glow tinged the lower bowl of the chimney, and he shucked out of his brogans and his trousers and shirt and lay back on the mattress, naked, save for his socks. Hunters had stripped most of the boards from the inside walls for firewood, and from the bare lintel above the window hung part of the belly and tail of a black snake. Ballard sat up and turned up the lamp again. He rose and reached and prodded the pale blue underside of the snake with his finger. It shot forward and dropped to the floor with a thud and rifled over the boards like ink running in a gutter and was out the door and gone. Ballard sat back down on the mattress and turned the lamp down again and lay back. He could hear mosquitoes droning toward him in the hot silence. He lay there listening. After a while, he turned over on his stomach, and after a while he got up and got the rifle from where it stood by the fireplace and laid it on the floor alongside the mattress and stretched out again. He was very thirsty. In the night, he dreamt streams of ice-black mountain water, lying there on his back with his mouth open like a dead man. I remember one thing he done one time. I was raised with him over in the tent. I was ahead of him in school. He lost a softball down off the road that rolled down into this field about, well, it was way off down in a bunch of briars and stuff, and he told this boy, this Finney boy, told him to go and get it. A Finney boy was some bit younger than him, told him, said, go get that softball. Well, Finney boy wouldn't do it. Lester walked up to him and said, you better go get that ball. Finney boy said he wasn't about to do it, and Lester told him one more time, said, you don't get off down in there and get me that ball, I'm going to bust you in the mouth. Well, that Finney boy was scared, but he faced up to him, told him he hadn't throwed it off down in there. Well, we were standing there, the way you will. Ballard could have let it go. He seen the boy wasn't going to do what he asked him. He just stood there a minute, and then he punched him in the face. Blood flew out of the Finney boy's nose, and he sat down in the road. Just for a minute, and then he got up. Somebody give him a kerchief, and he put it to his nose. It was all swole up and bleeding. The Finney boy just looked at Lester Ballard and went on up the road. I felt, I don't know what it was. We just felt real bad. I never liked Lester Ballard from that day. I never liked him much before that. He never done nothing to me. Ballard lay in the night damp, with his heart hammering against the earth. He was watching a parked car through the sparse pale of leaning weeds that rimmed the Frog Mountain turnaround. Inside the car, a cigarette flared and lapsed, and a late-night DJ commented with mindless chatter on the seduction in the rear seat. A beer can clattered in the gravel. A mockingbird that had been singing stopped. He came from the roadside, ducked in a loping run, a shadow that washed up against the cold, dusty hind fender of the automobile. His breath was shallow, his eyes wide, his ears pricked to sort the voices from the ones on the radio. A girl said, Bobby. Then she said it again. Ballard had his ear to the quarter panel. The car began to rock gently. He raised himself up and chanced one eye at the window corner. A pair of white legs sprawled, embracing a shade, a dark incubus that humped in a dream of slaverous lust. It's a nigger, whispered Ballard.
Oh, Bobby! Oh, God! Said the girl.
Ballard, unbuttoned, spent himself on the fender.
Oh, shit! Said the girl.
On buckling knees, the watcher watched. The mockingbird began.
A nigger, said Ballard.
But it was not a black face that loomed in the window, that looked so enormous there behind the glass. For a moment, they were face to face, and then Ballard dropped to the ground, his heart pounding. The radio music ended in a muted click and didn't start again. The door opened on the far side of the car. Ballard, a misplaced and loveless simian shape, scuttling across the turnaround as he had come, over the clay and thin gravel and the flattened beer cans and papers and rotting condoms.
You better run, you son of a bitch!
The voice washed against the mountain and came back lost and threatless. Then there was nothing but silence and the rich bloom of honeysuckle on the black midsummer night air. The car started, the lights came on, and swung around the circle, and went down the road.
I don't know. They say he was never right after his daddy killed himself. They was just the one boy. The mother had run off, I don't know where to nor who with. Me and Cecil Edwards was the ones cut him down. He come in the store and told it like you'd tell it was raining out. We went up there and walked in the barn, and I seen his feet hanging. We just cut him down, let him fall on the floor, just like cutting down meat. Well, he stood there and watched, never said nothing. He's about 9 or 10 year old at the time. The old man's eyes was run out on stems like a crawfish, and his tongue blacker than a chow dog's. I wished if a man wanted to hang himself, he'd do it with poison or something so folks wouldn't have to see such a thing as that.
He didn't look so pretty himself when Greer got done with him.
No, but I don't mind honest blood. I'd rather to see that than eyeballs hanging out and such.
I'll tell you what old Gresham done when his wife died and how crazy he was. They buried her up here at 6 Mile, and the preacher, he said a few words, and then he called on Gresham, asked him, did he want to say a few words before they throwed the dirt over her? And old Gresham, he stood up, had his hat in his hand and all, stood up there and sung the Chicken Shit Blues. The Chicken Shit Blues. No, I don't know the words to it, but he did, and he sung 'em every one, for he set back down again. But he wasn't a patch on Lester Ballard for crazy.
Were there darker provinces of night, he would have found them. Lying with his fingers plugged in the bores of his ears against the strident cheeping of the myriad black crickets with which he kept household in the barren cabin. One night on his pallet, while half asleep, he heard something scamper through the room and vault ghostly, he saw, struggling erect, through the open window. He sat there, looking after it, but it was gone. He could hear foxhounds in full cry, tortured wails and yelps nigh unto agony coming up the creek, up the valley. They flooded into the cabin yard in a pandemonium of soprano howls and crashing brush. Ballard, standing naked, saw by palest starlight the front door fill from floor sill up with bawling dogs. They hung there for a moment in a pulsing frame of piebald fur, and then bowed through and filled the room, circled once with rising volume, dog on dog, and then swept out the window, howl on howl, carrying first the muntins, then the sash, leaving a square and naked hole in the wall and a ringing in his ear. While he stood there cursing, two more dogs came through the door. He kicked one as it passed and stove his bare toes on its bony rump. He was hopping about on one foot, shrieking, when a final hound entered the room. He fell upon it and seized its hind leg. It set up a piteous howling. Ballard flailed blindly at it with his fist, great drum-like thumps that echoed in the near-empty room among the desperate oaths and wailings. Going up a track of a road through the quarry woods, where all about lay enormous blocks and tablets of stone, weathered gray and grown with deep green moss, toppled monoliths among the trees and vines like traces of an older race of man. This rainy summer day. He passed a dark lake of silent jade where the moss walls rose sheer and plumb, and a small bluebird sat slant upon a guy wire in the void. Ballard leveled the rifle at the bird, but something of an old foreboding made him hold. Mayhaps the bird felt it too. It flew, small, tiny, gone. The woods were filled with silence. Ballard let the hammer down with the ball of his thumb, and wearing the rifle on his neck like a yoke with his hands dangling over barrel and buttstock, he went up the quarry road. The mud packed with tins trod flat, with broken glass. The bushes strewn with refuse. Yonder, through the woods, a roof and smoke from a chimney. He came into a clearing where two cars lay upturned at either side of the road like wrecked sentinels, and he went past great levees of junk and garbage toward the shack at the edge of the dump. An assortment of cats, taking the weak sun, watched him go. Ballard pointed the rifle at a large mottled tom and said, "Bang." The cat looked at him without interest. It seemed to think him not too bright. Ballard spat on it, and it immediately wiped the spittle from its head with a heavy forepaw and set about washing the spot. Ballard went on up the path through the trash and car parts. The dump keeper had spawned 9 daughters and named them out of an old medical dictionary gleaned from the rubbish he picked. These gangling progeny with black hair hanging from their armpits now sat idle and wide-eyed day after day in chairs and crates about the little yard cleared out of the tips while their harried dam called them one by one to help with chores, and one by one they shrugged or blinked their sluggard lids. Urethra, cerebella, hernia sue. They moved like cats, and like cats in heat attracted surrounding swains to their midden, until the old man used to go out at night and fire a shotgun at random just to clear the air. He couldn't tell which was the oldest or what age, and he didn't know whether they should go out with boys or not. Like cats, they sensed his lack of resolution. They were coming and going all hours in all manner of degenerate cars, a dissolute carousel of rotting sedans and niggerized convertibles with blue dot tail lamps and chrome horns and foxtails and giant dice or dashboard demons of spurious fur, all patched up out of parts and low slung and bumping over the ruts, filled with old lanky country boys with long cocks and big feet. They fell pregnant, one by one. He beat them. The wife cried and cried. There were 3 births that summer. The house was filling up, both rooms, the trailer. People were sleeping everywhere. One brought home what she said was a husband, but he only stayed a day or two, and they never saw him again. The 12-year-old began to swell. The air grew close, grew rank and fetid. He found a pile of rags in a corner, small lumps of yellow shit wrapped up and laid by. One day in the woods and kudzu jungles on the far side of the dump, he came across 2 figures humping away. He watched from behind a tree until he recognized one of his girls. He tried to creep up on them, but the boy was wary and leaped up and was away through the woods, hauling up his britches as he went. The old man began to beat the girl with the stick he carried. She grabbed it. He overbalanced. They sprawled together in the leaves, hot, fishy reek of her freshened loins. Her peach drawers hung from a bush. The air about him grew electric. Next thing he knew, his overalls were about his knees, and he was mounting her.
"Daddy, quit," she said. "Daddy, oh."
"Did he dump a load in you?"
"No."
He pulled it out and gripped it and squirted his jism on her thigh.
"God damn you," he said.
He rose and heisted up his overalls and lumbered off toward the dump like a bear. Then there was Ballard. He'd come up the path with his narrow-eyed and studied indifference and the rifle in his hand or on his shoulders, or he'd sit with the old man in the bloated sofa in the yard, drinking with him from a half-gallon jar of Popskull whiskey and passing a raw potato back and forth for a chaser, while the younger girls peeped and giggled from the shack. He had eyes for a long, blonde, flat-shanked daughter that used to sit with her legs propped so that you could see her drawers. She laughed all the time. He'd never seen her in a pair of shoes, but she had a different colored pair of drawers for every day of the week, and black ones on Saturday. When Ballard came past the trailer, this very one was hanging up wash. There was a man with her, sitting on a 50-gallon drum, and he turned and squinted at Ballard and spoke to him. The girl pursed her lips at him and winked, and then threw back her head and laughed wildly. Ballard grinned, tapping the rifle barrel against the side of his leg.
"What say, Jelly Bean?" she said.
"What you laughing at?"
"What you looking at?"
"Why, he's looking at them there nice titties, for one thing," said the man on the drum.
"You want to see 'em?"
"Sure," said Ballard.
"Give me a quarter."
"I ain't got one," she laughed. He stood there grinning.
"How much you got?"
"I got a dime."
"Well, go borrow 2.5 cents and you can see one of 'em."
"Just let me owe ye," said Ballard.
"Say you want to blow me?"
the girl said.
"I said oh," said Ballard, flushing.
The man on the drum slapped his knee.
Watch out, he said. What you got that Lester can see for a dime?
He's done looked a half dollar's worth now.
Shoot, I ain't seen nothing.
You don't need to see nothing,
she said, bending and picking up a wet piece of cloth from the dishpan and shaking it out. Ballard trying to see down the neck of her dress. She raised up.
Just make your Peter hard,
she said, turning her back and laughing again that sudden half-crazy laugh.
Why, cat couldn't bite it now, could it, Lester?
I ain't got time to mess with y'all,
the girl said, turning back with a grin and picking up the pan. She cocked her hip and set the pan on it and looked at them. Beyond the little trailer, the old man walked against the sky, rolling a tire, and a ropey column of foul black smoke rose from a burning slag heap of old rubber.
Shit, she said. If you'ns ever got any of this, you never would be satisfied again.
They watched her saunter up the hill toward the house.
I'd like to chance it, the man said. Wouldn't you, Lester?
Ballard said that he would. The congregation at Six Mile Church would turn altogether like a cast of puppets at the opening of the door behind them any time after services had started. When Ballard came in with his hat in his hand and shut the door and sat alone on the rear bench, they turned back more slowly. A windy riffle of whispers went among them. The preacher stopped. To justify the silence, he poured himself a glass of water from the pitcher on the pulpit, and drank and set the glass back and wiped his mouth.
Brethren, he went on, a biblical babbling to Ballard, who read the notices on the board at the back of the church.
This week's offering, last week's offering, $6.74. The numbers in attendance. A woodpecker hammered at a drainpipe outside, and those strung heads listed and turned to the bird for silence. Ballard had a cold and snuffled loudly through the service, but nobody expected he would stop if God himself looked back askance, so no one looked. In late summer, there were bass in the creek. Ballard went from pool to pool on the down sun side, peering through the bushes. He'd been on a diet of stolen field corn and summer garden stuff for weeks, save for the few frogs he'd shot. He knelt in the high grass and spoke to the fish where they stood in the clear water on wimpling fins.
"Ain't you a fine fat son of a bitch?" he said.
He fairly loped toward the house. When he came back, he had the rifle. He made his way along the creek and eased himself through the sedge and briars. He checked the sun to see it wouldn't be in his eyes, making his way on all fours, the rifle cocked. He peered over the bank, then he raised up on his knees, then he stood up. Upstream below the ford, Waldrop's cattle stood belly deep in the creek.
"You sons of bitches!" croaked Ballard.
The creek was thick red with mud. He brought the rifle up and leveled it and fired. The cattle veered and surged in the red water, their eyes white. One of them made its way toward the bank, holding its head at an odd angle. At the bank, it slipped and fell and rose again. Ballard watched it with his jaw knotted.
"Oh, shit," he said.
"I'll tell you another thing he done one time. He had this old cow to balk on him. Couldn't get her to do nothing. He pushed and pulled and beat on her till she'd wore him out. He went and borrowed Squire Helton's tractor and went back over there and throwed a rope over the old cow's head and took off on the tractor hard as he could go. When it took up the slack, it like to have jerked her head plumb off, broke her neck and killed her where she stood. Ask Floyd if he didn't."
"I don't know what he had on Waldrop that Waldrop never would run him off. Even after he burned his old place down, he never said nothing to him about it that I know of."
"That reminds me of that Trantham boy that had them old-timey oxes over at the fair here a year or two back. They sulled up on him and wouldn't go, till finally he took and built a fire in underneath of them. The old oxes looked down and seen it, and took about five steps, and quit again. Trantham boy looked, and there set the fire directly in under his wagon. He hollered and crawled up under the wagon and commenced a beating at the fire with his hat, and about that time, them old oxes took off again, drug the wagon over him, and like to broke both his legs. You never seen more contrary beasts than them was.
"Come up, Lester," said the dump keeper.
Ballard was coming. He didn't need asking.
"Howdy, Rubel," he said.
They sat in the sofa and looked at the ground, the old man tapping his stick up and down, Ballard holding the rifle upright between his knees.
"When we going to shoot some more rats?"
said the old man. Ballard spat.
"Any time you want," he said.
"They about to carry us off out here."
Ballard cut his eyes toward the house, where he'd seen a half-naked girl cross in the gloom. A baby was crying.
"I don't reckon you've seen them, have ye?"
"What's that?"
"Ernie and that next to Leaston."
"Where are they at?"
"I don't know," said the old man. "They cut out, I reckon. Been gone 3 days."
"That fair-headed one?"
"Yeah, her and Herney. I reckon they've took off with some of these here jelly beans."
"Well," said Ballard,
"I don't know what makes them girls so wild. Their grandmother was the biggest woman for church-going you ever seen. Where you going, Lester?"
"I got to go."
"Best not rush off in the heat of the day."
"Yeah," said Ballard, "I'm going to walk out this-a-way."
"You see any rats, why just shoot 'em."
"If I see any."
"You'll see some."
A dog followed him out the quarry road. Ballard gave a little dry whistle and snapped his fingers, and the dog sniffed at his cuff. They went on up the road. Ballard descended by giant stone stairs to the dry floor of the quarry, the great rock walls with their cantilevered faces and feather drill holes composed about him an enormous amphitheater. The ruins of an old truck lay rusting in the honeysuckle. He crossed the corrugated stone floor among chips and spalls of stone. The truck looked like it had been machine-gunned. At the far end of the quarry was a rubble tip, and Ballard stopped to search for artifacts, tilting old stoves and water heaters, inspecting bicycle parts and corroded buckets. He salvaged a worn kitchen knife with a chewed handle. He called the dog, his voice relaying from rock to rock and back again. When he came out to the road again, a wind had come up. A door somewhere was banging, an eerie sound in the empty wood. Ballard walked up the road. He passed a rusted tin shed, and beyond it, a wooden tower. He looked up. High up on the tower, a door creaked open and clapped shut. Ballard looked around. Sheets of roofing tin clattered and banged, and a white dust was blowing off the barren yard by the quarry shed. Ballard squinted in the dust, looking up the road. By the time he got to the county road, it had begun to spit rain. He called the dog once more, and he waited, and then he went on. The weather turned overnight. With the fall, the sky grew bluer than he'd ever known or could remember. He sat hour-long in the windy sedge with the sun on his back, as if he'd store the warmth of it against the coming winter. He watched a corn picker go snarling through the fields, and in the evening he and the doves went husbanding among the chewed and broken stalks, and he gathered several sackfuls and carried them to the cabin before dark. The hardwood trees on the mountains subsided into yellow and flame and to ultimate nakedness. An early winter fell. A cold wind sucked among the black and barren branches. Alone in the empty shell of a house, the squatter watched through the moat-blown glass a rim shard of bone-colored moon come cradling up over the black balsams on the ridge, ink trees a facile hand had sketched against the paler dark of winter heavens. A man, much for himself, drinkers gone to Kirby's, would see him on the road by night, slouched and solitary, the rifle hanging in his hand as if it were a thing he could not get shut of. He'd grown lean and bitter. Some said mad. A malign star kept him. He stood in the crossroads, listening to other men's hounds on the mountain, a figure of wretched arrogance in the lights of the few cars passing.
In their coiling dust, he cursed or muttered or spat after them. The men, tightly shouldered in the high old sedans, with guns and jars of whiskey among them, and lean tree dogs curled in the turtle deck. One cold morning on the Frog Mountain turnaround, he found a lady sleeping under the trees in a white gown. He watched her for a while to see if she were dead. He threw a rock or two, one touched her leg. She stirred heavily, her hair all caught with leaves. He went closer. He could see her heavy breasts sprawled under the thin stuff of her nightdress, and he could see the dark thatch of hair under her belly. He knelt and touched her. Her slack mouth twisted, her eyes opened. They seemed to open downward by the underlids, like a bird's, and her eyeballs were gorged with blood. She sat up suddenly, a sweet ferment of whiskey and rot coming off her. Her lip drew back in a cat snarl.
"What do you want, you son of a bitch?"
she said.
"Ain't you cold?"
"What the hell is it to you?"
"It ain't a damn thing to me."
Ballard had risen and stood above her with a rifle.
"Where's your clothes at?"
She rose up and staggered backwards and sat down hard in the leaves. Then she got up again. She stood there, weaving and glaring at him with her puffed and heavy-lidded eyes.
"Son of a bitch," she said.
Her eyes were casting about. Spying a rock, she lunged and scrabbled it up and stood him off with it. Ballard's eyes narrowed.
"You better put down that rock," he said.
"You make me."
"I said to put it down."
She drew the rock back menacingly. He took a step forward. She heaved the rock and hit him in the chest with it, and then covered her face with her hands. He slapped her so hard it spun her back around, facing him. She said,
"I know you do me this away."
Ballard touched his hand to his chest and glanced down quickly to check for blood, but there was none. She had her face buried in her hands. He took hold of the strap of her gown and gave it a good yank. The thin material parted to the waist. She turned loose of her face and grabbed at the gown. Her nipples were hard and blue-looking with the cold.
"Quit," she said.
Ballard seized a fistful of the wispy rayon and snatched it. Her feet came from under her, and she sat in the trampled frozen weeds. He folded the garment under his arm and stepped back. Then he turned and went on down the road. She sat, stark naked on the ground, and watched him go, calling various names after him. None his.
"Fate's all right. He's plain-spoken, but I like him. I've rode with him a lot of times. I remember one night up on the Frog Mountain at the turnaround. There was a car parked up there, and Fate put the lights on him and walked on up there. The old boy in the car was all yes, sir, and no, sir. Had this girl with him. He asked the old boy for his license, and the old boy scratched around for the longest time. Couldn't find his pocketbook nor nothing. Fate finally told him, said, 'Step out here.' Said the old girl sitting there was as white as a sheet. Well, the old boy opened the door and out he steps. Fate looked at him, and then he hollered at me, said, 'John, come here and see this.' I went on up there, and the old boy is standing by the side of the car, looking down, and the sheriff is looking down, got the light on him. We're all standing there looking down at this old boy, and he's got his britches on inside out. Pockets hanging outside all around. Look crazier than hell. Sheriff just told him to go on. Asked him if he could drive like that. That's the kind of feller he is."
When Ballard came out onto the porch, there was a thin man with a collapsed jaw squatting in the yard waiting for him.
"What say, Darfuzzle?" said Ballard.
"What say, Lester?"
He sounded like a man with a mouth full of marbles, articulating his goat-bone underjaw laboriously, the original one having been shot away. Ballard squatted on his heels in the yard opposite the visitor. They looked like constipated gargoyles.
"Say, you found that old gal up on the turnaround?"
Ballard sniffed.
"What gal?" he said.
"That 'un was left up yonder, had on a nightgown."
Ballard pulled at the loose sole of his shoe.
"I seen her," he said.
"She went to the sheriff.
She has. The other man turned and spat and looked back toward Ballard.
They done arrested Pless.
That's your all's lookout. I didn't have nothing to do with her.
She says you did.
She's a lying sack of green shit.
The visitor rose.
I just thought I'd tell ye, he said. You do what you want.
The high sheriff of Sevier County came out through the courthouse doors and stood on the portico, surveying the gray lawn below with the benches and the Sevier County Pocket Knife Society that convened there to whittle and mutter and spit. He rolled a cigarette and replaced the package of tobacco in the breast pocket of his tailored shirt and lit the cigarette and descended the stairs, a proprietary squint to his eyes as he studied the morning aspect of this small upland county seat. A man opened the door and called down to him, and the sheriff turned.
"Mr. Gibson's hunting you,"
the man said.
"You don't know where I'm at."
"Okay."
"And where the hell is Cotton?"
"He's went to get the car."
"He better get his ass on up here."
"Yonder he comes now, sheriff."
The sheriff turned and went on out to the street.
"Morning, sheriff."
"Morning."
"Morning, sheriff. Hey, how are you?"
He flipped the cigarette into the street and stepped into the car and pulled the door to.
"Morning, sheriff,"
said the driver.
"Let's go get the little fucker,"
said the sheriff.
"Me and Bill Parsons was going to go bird hunting this morning, but I don't reckon we will now." "Bill Parsons, eh? He's got a couple of good dogs." "Oh, yeah. He always has the best dogs. I remember a dog he had one time named Susie he said was a hellacious bird dog. He let her out of the trunk, and I looked at her, and I said, 'I don't believe Susie's feeling too good.' He looked at her and felt her nose and all. Said she looked all right to him. I told him, said, 'I just don't believe she's real well today.' We set out and hunted all afternoon and killed one bird. Started walking back to the car, and he says to me, Bill says, 'You know, it's funny you noticing old Susie was not feeling good today. The way you spotted it.' I said, 'Well, Susie was sick today.' He said, 'Yes, she was.' I said, 'Susie was sick yesterday. Susie has always been sick. Susie will always be sick. Susie is a sick dog.'"
He watched the sheriff stop out on the road a quarter mile away, and he watched him ford the sheer wall of dry briars and weeds at the edge of the road and come on with arms and elbows aloft, treading down the brush. When he got to the house, his pressed and tailored chinos were dusty and wilted, and he was covered with dead beggar lice and burrs, and he was not happy. Ballard stood on the porch.
"Let's go,"
said the sheriff.
"Where to?" "You better get your ass down off that porch."
Ballard spat and unleaned himself from the porch post.
"You got it all," he said.
He came down the steps, his hands in the rear pockets of his jeans.
"Man of leisure like yourself," the sheriff said, "you oughtn't to mind helping us workers unscramble a little misunderstanding. This way, mister."
"This way," said Ballard. "There's a path if you don't know it."
Ballard in a varnished oak swivel chair, he leans back. The door is pebble-grain glass. Shadows loom upon it. The door opens. A deputy comes in and turns around. There's a woman behind him. When she sees Ballard, she starts to laugh. Ballard is craning his neck to see her. She comes through the door and stands looking at him. He looks down at his knee. He begins to scratch his knee. The sheriff got up from his desk.
"Shut the door, Cotton."
"This son of a bitch here," the woman said, pointing at Ballard. "Where the hell did you find him at?"
"Is he not the one?"
"Well, yes, he's the one. The one, it's them other two sons of bitches I want jailed. This son of a bitch here."
She threw up her hands in disgust. Ballard scuffed one heel along the floor.
"I ain't done nothing," he said. "Did you want to make a charge against this man or not?"
"Hell yes, I do."
"What did you want to charge him with?"
"Rape, by God."
Ballard laughed woodenly.
"Assault and battery too, you son of a bitch."
"She ain't nothing but a goddamned old whore."
The old whore slapped Ballard's mouth. Ballard came up from the swivel chair and began to choke her. She brought her knee up into his groin. They grappled. They fell backward, upsetting a tin wastebasket. A hall tree toppled with its load of coats. The sheriff's deputy seized Ballard by the collar. Ballard wheeled. The woman was screaming. The three of them crashed to the floor. The deputy jerked Ballard's arm up behind him. He was livid.
"You goddamned bitch," Ballard said.
"Get her," the sheriff said. "Get." The deputy had one knee in the small of Ballard's back. The woman had risen. She cocked her elbows and drew back her foot and kicked Ballard in the side of the head. "Here now," said the deputy. She kicked again. He grabbed her foot and she sat down on the floor. "God damn it, sheriff," he said. "Get her or him one, will ye?"
"You sons of bitches," said Ballard.
He was almost crying.
"God damn all of ye."
"Bet me," said the woman. "I'll kick his goddamn cards off, the son of a bitch."
9 days and nights in the Sevier County Jail. White beans with fat back and boiled greens and bologna sandwiches on light bread. Ballard thought the fare not bad. He even liked the coffee. They had a nigger in the cell opposite, and the nigger used to sing all the time. He was being held on a fugitive warrant. After a day or two, Ballard fell into talking with him. He said,
"What's your name?"
"John," said the nigger. "Nigger John.
Where you from? You a fugitive, ain't you?"
"I'm from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and I'm a fugitive from the ways of this world. I'd be a fugitive from my mind if I had me some snow."
"What you in for?"
"I cut a motherfucker's head off with a pocket knife." Ballard waited to be asked his own crime, but he wasn't asked. After a while, he said,
"I supposed to have raped this old girl. She's nothing but a whore to start with."
"White pussy is nothing but trouble." Ballard agreed that it was. He guessed he'd thought so, but he'd never heard it put that way. The black sat on his cot and rocked back and forth. He crooned, "Flyin' home, fly like a motherfucker, flyin' home."
"All the trouble I ever was in," said Ballard, "was caused by whiskey or women or both."
He'd often heard men say as much. "All the trouble I ever was in was caused by getting caught," said the black. After a week, the sheriff came down the corridor one day and took the nigger away. "Flyin' home," sang the nigger.
"You'll be flying all right," said the sheriff. "Home to your maker. Fly like a motherfucker," sang the nigger.
"Take it easy," called Ballard.
The nigger didn't say if he would or wouldn't. The next day, the sheriff came again and stopped in front of Ballard's cage and peered in at him. Ballard peered back. The sheriff had a straw in his teeth, and he took it out to speak. He said,
"Where was that woman from?"
"What woman?"
"The one you raped.
You mean that old whore?"
"All right, that old whore."
"I don't know. How the hell would I know where she was from?"
"Was she from Sevier County?"
"I don't know, damn it."
The sheriff looked at him and put the straw back in his teeth and went away. They came for Ballard the next morning, turnkey and bailiff.
"Ballard," the turnkey said.
"Yeah."
He followed the bailiff down the corridor. The turnkey followed. They went downstairs, Ballard easing himself along the iron banister pipe. They went outside and across a parking lot to the courthouse. They sat him in a chair in an empty room. He could see a thin strip of color and movement through the gap of the double doors, and he listened vaguely to legal proceedings. After an hour or so, the bailiff came in and crooked his finger at Ballard. Ballard rose and went through the doors and sat in a church bench behind a little rail. He heard his name. He closed his eyes. He opened them again. A man in a white shirt at the desk looked at him and looked at some papers, and then he looked at the sheriff.
"Since when?" he said.
"It's been a week or better."
"Well, tell him to get on out of here."
The bailiff came over and opened the gate and leaned toward Ballard.
"You can go," he said.
Ballard stood up and went through the gate and across the room toward a door with daylight in it, and across a hall and out through the front door of the Sevier County Courthouse. No one called him back. A drooling man at the door held out a greasy hat at him and mumbled something. Ballard went down the steps and crossed the street. Uptown, he walked around in the stores. He went into the post office and looked through the sheaves of posters. The wanted stared back with surly eyes. Men of many names, their tattoos, legends of dead loves inscribed on perishable flesh, a prevalence of blue panthers. He was standing in the street with his hands in his back pockets when the sheriff walked up.
"What's your plans now?" said the sheriff.